Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Julia Salabank about her book Attitudes to Endangered Languages, a book that explores some of the sociological aspects of language revitalization. We talk particularly about the indigenous languages of the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, and consider how language revitalization programs raise issues of language ownership, cultural identity, and attitudes to language change. I'm delighted to welcome Julia Salabank from SOAS, University of London, to talk about her new book, Attitudes to Endangered Languages, in which she discusses the social aspects of language revitalization, with particular reference to Guernsey, Jersey, and the Isle of Man. Julia, how did you become interested in this topic?
I've been interested particularly in Guernsey for a long time. Well, my mother comes from Guernsey, and I've always been fascinated in the language. We went there a lot when I was young, and that was really my kind of inroad into endangered languages. And as soon as I started saying that I was interested in studying the language, I got some interesting reactions, let's say, from members of my family. And that got me immediately interested in the attitudes and ideological aspects of language endangerment, language revitalization. And then, I decided to broaden my approach, compare what was going on there with other places.
Your particular focus is on the languages of Jersey, Guernsey, and the Isle of Man. I wonder if you could give us a little sketch of the linguistic situation in those places.
These are three small islands around the British Isles. They're all relatively similar in terms of size and population within a degree. They've all got indigenous languages or have had indigenous languages. The Isle of Man's language, Manx, some people say it died out. Other people would say there's been a continuum of people learning and speaking it. But certainly the last so-called native speaker, or traditional speaker, died in the 1970s. Well, even before then, there was a movement to try and revive Manx. But it's been particularly successful since the 1980s, 1990s. Manx is a Celtic language. It's very, quite closely related to Scottish Gaelic and Irish Gaelic, if you like. And in fact, the Manx word for Manx is Gaelic, which is Gaelic or Gaelic. Whereas Channel Islands languages are varieties of Norman, as in Norman conquest. They were part of Normandy when Normandy invaded England in 1066. Jerie, the language of Jersey, and Genesee, the language of Guernsey, are really quite highly endangered in that they have now very few, very elderly, fluent native traditional speakers, and unfortunately have not been that successful yet in reviving the languages. So there are very few young people who have learnt the language effectively. Whereas in the Isle of Man, the language revitalization program has been relatively successful in that, for example, they've got a whole school with 70 kids learning everything through Manx and possibly about 100 or more other fluent speakers who've learnt it in various ways. So my interest then became piqued by trying to look at what one could learn from the commonalities and the differences, and particularly what the Channel Islands could learn from what the Isle of Man has been doing.
I mean, one sort of striking difference with this study versus others is that when we hear about so-called language death, it's very often in the context of marginalised communities of low socioeconomic status, whereas that's not particularly the case here, is it?
No, indeed, no. These communities might be seen as fairly well off, or they are fairly well off by most people's standards. And that may, according to one of my colleagues, Gary Wilson, that's actually one of the factors in language revitalization, particularly in the Isle of Man, that the economic situation made it possible for people to kind of start thinking about other things apart from just making a living. The factors, very often language shift is related to economic factors. People are motivated to learn a language which they perceive is better for them, better for their children, in particular in terms of education, getting a good job, making a better living, kind of forgetting that it's possible to add a language to your repertoire rather than replace one by another. And that's kind of also kind of part of the whole sort of monolingual ideology that tends to dominate in Western Europe. Some people have likened this to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. People at the bottom of the hierarchy of needs are concerned with basic survival, food, shelter, etc. Whereas higher up, they can get more interested in what is called self-actualization, identity factors, that kind of thing. Now, some of my colleagues find this quite insulting to members of endangered language communities, kind of implication that just because you're poor, you can't think about your identity. So it has also been pointed out that this is just a hypothesis, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs never actually been proven. But that's just one theory that some people have put forward.
You mentioned that connection, that it's quite often people of middle class and upwards who are especially interested in the revitalization efforts that have been made.
Yes and no. I think we can see people of all backgrounds interested in language revitalization. I think it's perceived that way. Now, certainly that's been one reaction that I've had. Oh, only intellectuals are interested in saving the language. But it's a perception, I think, rather than necessarily a research finding again.
Sure. You mentioned that the language revitalization efforts for Manx are somewhat further along and have been something of a touchstone for language planning in Guernsey and Jersey, as I understand it. How do you feel that comparison has been used? How has that played out?
In Jersey in particular, they have quite overtly referred to Manx revitalization as something that's inspired them and actually gone to the Manx language revitalization office. I'm not sure what stage it's been, back when it was first started, and got copies of their materials and translated them at the beginning to help teach JRE. But I think in more recent years, the inspiration has been more in terms of inspiration rather than actually looking at what makes the Manx revival so successful. And I think it is successful. I think it's one of the most successful I've actually seen anywhere in the world. If you think about the fact that they didn't have any native speakers left in the 70s, but now they've got possibly 150-ish, 200 perhaps fluent or proficient, some people prefer to call it, speakers of Manx. Which is a remarkable turnaround, and a lot more people who know some and very positive attitudes towards Manx. And I think it's not just the other islands, but a lot of language revitalization movements could learn a lot from how Malaman has gone about it. But I think there are things that people tend to forget, and one of the things they've forgotten is that in the Isle of Man, they never didn't have speakers. I say in my book there's this kind of rhetoric of continuity, but there was actually continuity in that there were always people who had learnt Manx from native speakers or from other speakers. So adult learners, if you like, people who weren't dependent on language lessons for their fluency in the language. And those people back in the 70s and 80s provided a kind of core of language activists and language usage, which kept the language alive in what you might call the dark days, which I think are pretty imminent for Jersey and Guernsey, for their indigenous languages. And I think in that respect, it's quite worrying, but I recently realized that in Guernsey, there's probably only 5 people below the age of 60 who can speak the language, well, to the extent that they can have an impromptu conversation on a variety of topics for, let's say, more than about 20 minutes on, more than just the weather, for example, and possibly even fewer in Jersey. And so I really think that the adult language learning is really a vital intermediate step in keeping these languages alive.
An issue that surfaces time and again in your book is the difficulty, or if you like, the contested nature of how to use that expert knowledge. Could you discuss that a little?
When you say that expert knowledge, do you mean of native speakers or what?
Yes, native or older fluent speakers who have the, if you like, the claim to direct transmission.
Yes, it's more the more contested seems to be how to pass the language on, or even whether to pass the language on. I've been looking since I published this book, I've been looking particularly at adult learners and what they need. Most of the people that I've talked to, if they've got somebody, with some exceptions, I have to say, but quite a few of the people I've talked to have said that they would really love to have someone, an older person, particularly by definition, all of the native fluent speakers of Jerry and Jonesy are older. And learners would really love to have people to talk to in the language. It's one of their main problems. They don't have enough input. They don't have enough opportunities to practice. But if they're lucky enough to find someone or to have a relative or a neighbor, for example, who speaks the language that they can go and talk to, the reaction that they often get is something like, oh, we don't say it like that, or, oh, you never pronounce it like we do. And learners tend to find this off-putting, and they can get a bit demoralized because they don't tend to get positive feedback from native speakers with regard to their abilities. And frankly, there are not a lot, as I said, of proficient learners. And in Guernsey, until recently, there's been no opportunity to get beyond beginner level. But also because native speakers aren't used to teaching anyone to speak the language. It's a long time, 45 years, probably since anyone had a child and started to bring that child up in Guernsey. And people simply aren't used to anyone wanting to learn it. So there's a bit of sort of give and take needed on both sides. But there is also, I think, a bit of a possibly subconscious problem. People get worried about language change, by which they generally mean influence from English. They're not so worried about influence from French. We've turned this language ownership, some other people talk about legitimacy of language. It's sort of dichotomy that on the one hand, people say they want more people to learn the language. But on the other hand, they are worried about what those people might do with the language. And they kind of want to police it. And some people use the term language police, in fact. And they kind of forget that language change happens. And if people had carried on speaking and learning the language with their children, like in the Isle of Man, like it's actually happening in the Isle of Man, those kids would be busy trying to find where to say he's like and I'm like in Jerry and Genesee, and they wouldn't be speaking like their grandparents.
Do you feel that there's been a tendency to underestimate this sort of tension between the desire to have a language that is living going forward and to maintain this kind of purism? Do you think that's something that people trying to do language revitalizations have, if you like, rather optimistically overlooked?
Yes and no. I mean, some people are aware of it, and in fact, I think I'm not sure if I quote this report from one of the language societies in Guernsey, the annual review. It says something like, we're teaching a traditional form of a language, not a new form that some people seem to want to teach. Yeah. So some people are aware of this, and some people are actively opposed to language change. So, yeah. What kind of worries me is that learners are the future of the language, of any endangered language, and I don't think enough attention has been paid both to the differences between learning a small language and a big language, and also giving learners a voice in language policy, which until recently hasn't really happened, particularly in Guernsey, more in Jersey. I think they've got over that hump better.
Do you feel that there's a difference between the situation in the Isle of Man and in Jersey and Guernsey, insofar as in the Isle of Man there's only one roof language, as you describe it, namely English, whereas in Guernsey and Jersey the languages are pulled between these two rather powerful global languages that influence them.
Mm. There is, of course, a Celtic continuum in the Isle of Man, and in terms of policy, they have learnt a lot from Ireland, Wales, Scotland to a certain extent. Scotland is kind of less far, I think, in language revitalisation. And there are some Celtic scholars who I think would rather that Manx wasn't spelt in this funny way and kind of would remain part of a Celtic continuum. But as I say, it's not such an issue there, I don't think. I think people in the Isle of Man are quite kind of firm in seeing Manx as a definite language, whereas I think there's less self-confidence in that respect in Jersey and Guernsey, because for so long it was seen as a substandard dialect of French. Linguistically, some people, I think some linguists would still call it a dialect of French. And in fact, I'm at the moment having a dialogue with Ethnologue, which you may or may not know. It's a kind of big listing of languages, the major listing of languages that most people refer to when they first want to have some information about a language. And at the moment, they're listing Jerry and Genesee under French. and there have been moves to change that status, because Manx is listed separately, although arguably you could say there's at least as much mutual intelligibility between Irish and Manx as there is between Gerais and Genesier. I can understand some Irish because I can understand some Manx, for example. Whereas there was another researcher, Harry Thompson, did some research in the 90s between speakers of French and Genesier and discovered only about 25% mutual intelligibility in for oral recordings. But, you know, facts don't often get in the way of a good story or a good ideology. A lot of people have this idea that French is the correct way of writing Genesier, and in the 19th century, it was seen as the written form. Particularly some of the older people have this sort of ideology of deficit about Gerais and Genesier, and still see them as less valid forms of French. And people will say things like, oh, we haven't got words for this, we haven't got words for that. It's an earthy language, which is great. And there's a lot of joking in Genesier. But people don't see the possibility of changing that status, of making up or repurposing or agreeing on terms for modern things, for expanding the domains of use of Genesier and Gerais, whereas Manx is used for all kinds of things. You go to meetings of people involved in, I went to a meeting of a committee on broadcasting in Manx revitalization, and the whole meeting was held in Manx. Probably less English words than you get in the average Welsh conversation. If you listen to Welsh TV, if you look at stuff written online in Welsh, there's a lot of English words in there, actually. And very often there'll be words for things like technological stuff. But in Manx, they don't do that so much. And I think this is a deliberate attempt to expand the domains of the languages that some people are trying to do, particularly in Jersey. If you look at the Jersey Language Office's website or blog, in fact, there very often you'll see whole lists of words to do with new concepts, business, for example, meetings, environment, whatever, whatever's in the news. But at the moment, there's nothing agreed in that respect in Genesier. There's only kind of unofficial, private, between individuals attempts to expand the language use.
And as you discuss, in the absence of such attempts, there's a danger, or there's a possibility, perhaps I shouldn't say danger, that the language can get associated with, if you like, a purely heritage function. Mm.
Yes. That's very much the case in Guernsey, I think. It's very much associated with folkloric kind of songs and dances and stuff.
How do you perceive the prospects for if you like, going beyond that in the future? Is there, so to speak, a potential of a critical mass to keep the language alive if the right conditions are in place?
I think it's something we have to work for. This is why I'm doing this research on what might be needed to help more young adults and young adults to become involved and to become more fluent in the language. As I said, I think it's necessary to have a kind of core of people who are really committed to keeping the language alive by actually using it. They all need to be able to speak about things they want to speak about in their daily lives if it's really going to go anywhere.
I mean, this seems to chime with an issue you raise more generally about the success criteria for attempts in language revitalization. Mm. It's my impression that, although you don't want to be overtly critical of so to speak, very well-meaning attempts in this area, that people are maybe overly optimistic about what is achieved, if you like, under the rubric of awareness raising and so on, and that these efforts tend to have rather short-term consequences in a lot of cases, unless some tipping point mm-hmm. is reached. Is that a fair representation of the situation?
Possibly. It's quite possible there's some kind of pendulum swing in terms of attitudes. And it's very important to raise awareness. It's very important to improve attitudes. That's part of the problem with the attitude towards French in the Channel Islands, and the attitude that Genesier and Gerais have been substandard varieties of French. And I think there's more awareness and pride, particularly among politicians, that the islands have their own languages. And this is very much the case in the Isle of Man. That's another of their major achievements, you know, kind of get most of the politicians on board. But politicians don't tend to take it any further than that. As you say, having a language is enough for political distinctiveness. And it doesn't really matter whether it's folklorized or whether it's actually used fluently by lots of people. I mean, this is my own ideology, as I said in the book, comes out here, that I think to have a heritage or to have a language, a local language, it's got to be a living language. It's not much point in having a language that's just a few words in greetings, a few signposts that, you know, look quaint, a few songs and dances. And, you know, and people don't realize, people think all you need is English nowadays. Everyone speaks English. And because most people are monolingual in English, they don't realize partly the sheer joy of speaking your heritage language or a private language, even a secret language, of having a language that not everyone understands, that you can make comments about people in, for example. And that's the kind of motivation I've actually found among young people, teenagers. They say things like, oh, it would be cool to have our own language, you know, a secret language of our own. And young people aren't necessarily motivated by dressing up in old costumes. There are an increasing number of people, young people, particularly school children, who take part in the main language festival in Guernsey, cultural festival, the Eisteddfod, which is taken from the Welsh. But they don't necessarily get involved in, all they do really is learn poems off by heart and read them out. At the moment, it hasn't gone beyond that, and they certainly haven't got involved in dressing up in old costumes and stuff. Yeah.
I suppose it does get to the question of what it means to have a language, part of cultural heritage, whose it is and what use is to be made of it. But with rather mixed feelings, for example, the idea of appropriation of little bits of or fragments of the language as some kind of badge of identity, in perhaps a rather inauthentic way. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Oh, that word authentic or inauthentic, people use it in all kinds of ways, and they all have their own meanings for it. And for some people, authentic means kind of purist, which means sort of towards the French, often in Guernsey. To me, authentic means what people actually do with language. And the trouble with researching that is what you sometimes find is not what people think they do. So we'll find things like language change, language variation, people not even necessarily realizing the way they say things. And that can conflict with how people think they use the language and how people think they should use the language. I don't think there's anything wrong in people using language as a badge of identity, as long as that doesn't stop other people actually using it the way they want to. I think there's space for people to do all kinds of things with language. And if you want to sing and dance, that's fine, no problem. I enjoy singing, but you wouldn't want to hear me. I think a bit of tolerance will be a good idea.
I suppose, I mean, is there a question of respect in there, or do you feel that that's, is that not something that would be a problem?
People haven't used that word, but yeah, I guess so, perhaps, yes. I think I prefer the word tolerance rather than respect. Yeah, tolerance, for example, for young people and the way they might want to use language. Yeah, tolerance in different people's approaches to language revitalization and language documentation. Not just thinking that the way you do it is the only way.
Sure. I'd like, in the light of that, to ask a question. So this is a very general question, perhaps not a very fair one, but it seems to me that the assumption is, I think, correctly, that if you revitalize the language, if you make it available, make it actually used by new generations of speakers, then because of language contact, among other things, and because of technological change, that there's likely to be very rapid change in the language under one influence or another. The question is essentially what exactly are you saving, or does that not matter? To put it another way, I mean, the purists have a very clear, it seems they have a very clear idea of what it is they want to save. They want, if you like, to save some of the past, is how I think you maybe characterize it. In this other case, you're creating a new means of expression in some sense. Is that?
Well, yes, in a way, both of those are myths. The language of the past is often a nostalgic view, which doesn't necessarily correlate with actually the reality of how the language is or what even was used. It's, as I said, it's often a sort of smartening up and Frenchification of how the language is actually used. If you look at some of the materials that have been made, you can see that in some of them. But also thing is that even if you didn't revitalize the language, it would change. In other contexts, it's been found that endangered languages change faster than healthy languages, which is a kind of it's interesting because on the other hand, a language that doesn't change is truly dead. You know, once there are no speakers at all, and it's all it is if you've got some recordings, they're in a museum somewhere, and that is your kind of preserved language in a jar rather than your preserved language as a living language. So you're not going to stop a language changing, I'm afraid, unless you just have it in the jar. And you know, this is what I worry that some people some people have said overtly that, you know, that they're more worried about language change than about language death, and you know, it won't be the language that we know, is a quote I've used quite a lot, but it won't be the language that anyone knows if you don't let people pick it up and run with it. You know, there is a worry that it will change out of all recognition, that. If you've got more and more anglicized terms, what older people tend to do when they talk about new things such as bathrooms, televisions, refrigerators and things, they'll use those words in English rather than create a Genesee term. And what some people would rather do is to create a local language term for those things so they can talk about them in their own language, and to actually use and to research the way that the language has always or traditionally formed new terms. So that they can actually do it that in a reconstituted, authentic way, if you like. Because, you know, this is another use of the word authentic. People tend to associate language change with language decline, which is another kind of highly charged term. And actually, you can, and there's another lady, Claire Ferguson, I have probably quoted in the book, that who's recently, in the last few years, done a PhD on language change in Genesee. And she herself says that you can see differences in how the so-called younger, i.e., for instance, 60-year-olds speak, and how the 80, 90-year-olds speak. Again, that's the kind of thing that purists don't want to know, don't want to recognize. But within a very few years, those 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds will be the language authorities because the older speakers won't be there anymore. And I can, you know, give you chapter and verse on particular aspects of the language that are changing in the usage of those so-called younger speakers. Things like simplification or regularization of verb forms, of plural forms, deconstruction of some elided forms, that kind of thing. And of course, you can also see change in the usage of people who are learning, and that's inevitable too. And you see that in Manx as well, changes in pronunciation. But even you can also see that in the semi-speakers who are the current 60, 70-year-old speakers of Genesee and Jerie. They have a different accent to the older speakers. That's very, very clear. Learners don't necessarily notice some of the differences in vowel length, for example, between plurals and singulars, which is a feature of Genesee. And that kind of thing will change, but languages do change. And you can look at recordings of English and you can see changes in accent, changing in usage. It's still English, it's still called English. There's a linguist who's been looking at modern Hebrew, and says and obviously it's really quite different. Hebrew was supposed to be the big success story of language revitalization, but the Hebrew that's spoken nowadays is very different from what was spoken in the Bible times, but it's still called Hebrew. There are people who claim it shouldn't be called Hebrew because it's so different. But yeah, any kind of language revitalization, language revival involves a certain reimagining, reconstitution of the language. This is the case of Cornish as well. Which is being revived after about, well, some people say 200 years, but they were probably speakers about 50, 70 years ago who were kind of semi-speakers.
It seems to me that, I mean, your book reflects a very high level of awareness of the fact that there are these competing interests or competing perceptions among various different groups within the speech community. And that they might have conflicting interests. Now, you mentioned, I think, above at some point, talking about the responsibility to promote accurate information. That is to say, in some sense, we're under an obligation as scientists to point out that this change is existing. So the possibility of fossilizing or crystallizing the language in some earlier stage of development has already passed, that cannot be achieved. Do you feel that
in some way politicizes you, and when if you like confronting or arguing with the positions of established authorities within the community.
Yeah, some people have suggested that linguists could act as arbiters between kind of different factions in language communities. And this is very common, that there are different factions in small language communities, not just in these islands. But as I said, the very fact that as a linguist one is finding evidence of ongoing language change kind of makes one be perceived as not unbiased, let's say. It's almost a case of shoot the messenger. So I think things have gone beyond me being seen as an impartial observer. Yeah, I think I'm definitely seen as on the side of we call it a dynamic versus static view of language, and I'm definitely as you can see on the kind of have a more dynamic view of language myself. Not all linguists do. Some linguists basically want to kind of find out how a language was spoken in its pure state and parcel that up and put it in a box. But they tend to be not so interested in language vitalization. I'm very much interested in linguistics, if you like, in the service of language communities. And communities is often used in a quite totalizing way, in a kind of quite overused, abused in linguistics. And many, most even possibly traditional communities are not necessarily terrifically democratic. So there are people who have prestige, kudos in the community, who have influence, and people respect a lot what they will say. It's just that if they're elders, then they're not necessarily going to be around forever. And really, I think that if the language is going to survive, that baton needs to be passed on to people who are keen on using it and keeping it going in whatever form. But I think there is a limit beyond which a language becomes something else. But then again, that's not necessarily for me to say. I can't make a decision on how the language should be in the future, and I don't think anyone else can as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask also whether you felt you were given these competing interests, mm-hmm. given this rather complex dynamic, whether you felt limited in what you can do as a to some extent outsider, albeit one with a personal family connection. Mm-hmm. Or whether you really feel that just as a practicality that your advocacy is limited in its effect because you're battling certain rather entrenched positions.
Yeah, I would love to be able to spend longer in Guernsey and set up what is called a master apprentice program, although some of my colleagues there feel that it's getting a bit late for that. I don't know if you're familiar with the master apprentice concept, comes from North America. Basically, you put together a learner or semi-speaker, someone who wants to become more fluent, with someone who is more fluent. You provide them with a certain amount of training to avoid the kind of problems that I mentioned earlier between learners and fluent speakers. And ideally, they spend a lot of time together, like 10 to 20 hours a week or more even. And the older person becomes the language mentor, and the younger person often becomes the language teacher in due course. And I would love to set up something like that in Guernsey. But as I say, some of my colleagues feel that the situation has got, in terms of the number of older speakers, people who are dying each week, you can see them in the newspaper, it's kind of a bit late for that. But yes, you're right. There's a limit to what I could do. Obviously, I've got friends and colleagues in Guernsey who are working there, but they too are just individuals. It would be nice if there was a bigger group of people. But that's something we're working towards. There are people who are learning. There are people who are getting quite good. A small group of learners. And yes, it's great to see that.
Turning back to the question of language and culture, you discuss at various points. You discuss the question of how people coming in from outside in all these communities relate to the language and the culture. Do you feel that the infusion of fresh blood is a promising sign for the maintenance of these languages?
I think anyone is welcome. This is something that Adrian Kane, the Manx language officer, has said quite overtly. You know, some people there say, oh, well, these people are not locals, you know, what do they matter? But he said, you know, anyone that's interested in language is welcome from his point of view. And he'd rather have an enthusiastic newcomer than someone who is, he says, you know, kind of as Manx as the hills, who's got quite negative attitudes towards the language, which there are still some people like that in all these islands, in every place. There are both types learning all of these languages, and in fact, quite, you know, some of the most prominent people involved in language revitalization are incomers, and people have all sorts of motivations. For a lot of people, it is because they have family members, grandparents, neighbors, even, who speak the language and have become fascinated by it. But in other cases, it's simply people who have come in and seem to discover, connect with something in the local culture and the local language and really want to learn it.
Is that something you feel is bound up or is special with the condition, as you said, islandness for these languages? Do you feel that promotes that kind of understanding?
Yes and no. I think it's true of other places as well that aren't necessarily islands. You can get kind of language islands. You can get people being parochial, no matter, you know, whether they've got a sea around them or not. Jersey and Guernsey, any Isle of Man as well, I mean, they all have the advantage of being very beautiful places, and people want to go there for that reason, if nothing else. I mean, there are a lot of people who go to all of these islands simply as tax exiles and actually don't have much contact with the local culture or society at all. But you do get a few who are, you know, not just tax exiles, who, yeah, really want to get interested in local culture and local society. And, yeah, for some of them, language is part of that.
I'd like to then ask, so as a more general question, picking up a book titled Attitudes to Endangered Languages, it's in some sense quite a surprise, unless you've read the blurb, but it's that it deals with languages that, at least from my geographical sense, are so close at hand, and for all of us are, you know, Western and in these somewhat familiar locations. Mm-hmm. How has the study of these informed your understanding or your work on language revitalization in other contexts, which maybe don't have quite the, well, that don't have these circumstances?
Yeah, you say you don't have these circumstances. On the one hand, as we were talking about earlier, that there are economic resources and a degree of well-being in these places. On the other hand, there is not a lot of funding, particularly in Guernsey, for language revitalization. There is more in the Isle of Man and some in Jersey. Well, in no respect can you say that the language revitalization is overfunded, I think. So this is really still dependent on the goodwill of groups and individuals. And I think that's the case everywhere. You've got to have commitment. You've got to have a core really of really committed individuals, like in the Isle of Man, that the young parents who decided they were going to bring up their children in Manx and start a school of their own. And that is something that can be learned from other places. You know, I have been to other places and I've looked at particularly about language attitudes, and even somewhere as different as New Caledonia, which I think I mentioned briefly in the book, you get similar attitudes. You've got, for the indigenous languages there, the particular place that I was in, a little village called Pueblo, people who were quite concerned at the loss of both language and culture, traditional language and culture, but at the same time who criticise the language usage of younger people who tend to do more code switching, mixing languages, and also, you know, whose language isn't the same as their parents. And like in the places I've talked about, and you get this in other places too. One of my colleagues has talked about this with regard to revitalization of Occitan in southern France. You, on the one hand, you've got, you know, people saying we want the young people to learn the languages, but if you criticise them when they do, they're going to turn around and say, oh well, you know, if you don't like the way I'm speaking it, well, I might as well speak French or English or whatever the high language is, because at least I can do that without being criticised. And this, I think, it's what happened in Guernsey after the Second World War as well, when the young people came back from being away for 5 years. You know, a lot of them weren't too confident in their one of their heritage languages, yes, and got criticised and sort of turned away from the language. Yeah, and as I say, you can see similar attitudes in many places around the world, and many places where there is language revitalization, there is a bit of a tension between. In some places like Basque Country, for example, there's a unified kind of modern Basque, which is being taught in schools. And some of the older dialect speakers find that difficult to understand and vice versa. And that is a bit of a problem because if you're not learning the language to connect with your roots, what are you learning it for?
Yeah. So in some sense, the opportunity to study these social dynamics in Guernsey or Jersey or the Isle of Man is a window into something that you think might be very much more general and cross-cultural.
Possibly, yes. I hesitate to use the word cross-cultural, and I think, you know, you can't make broad generalizations, but most places I've been, you've got similar dynamics going on, unfortunately, and colleagues of mine talk about this kind of thing. I had a student come to talk to me ostensibly about orthography, the way of the writing, particular language she was studying in Pakistan, but it turned out that the problem was really to do with community dynamics and who felt they wrote the language best.
Yeah, our time is nearly up, so I would like to ask, given the various possible directions in which one could take this, what are your own personal research priorities going forward?
Well, as I said, I'm very, very interested in the needs of particularly adult learners. I really think that where there's such a big gap now between the fluent speakers and anyone coming up at that, it's a lot of people assume that language revitalization means teaching it in schools. I think, yes, that may well be necessary, but if you haven't got anyone who's competent, both linguistically and in terms of teacher training, to actually teach those languages in schools, then you're not going to get very far that way. So really getting an adult, particularly young adult cohort of good speakers is really important. I'm looking for funding to actually develop a language course for Gen Z in particular, but I'm also interested in making links with people in other places, New Zealand in particular, North America. There are a few of them around the world who are looking at this kind of, at the motivations of learners of very small, highly endangered, what is now called post-vernacular languages, languages that are no longer used in society in general. Yeah, how to use those research findings, because I think, I'm an engaged researcher, and the big thing in research in this country nowadays is impact, not just impact in the academic community, but impact outside academia. And I see this is very useful impact in terms of trying to help revive endangered languages.
Indeed, and a very worthy cause. Yeah. I hope that hope we'll be hearing a lot more about these topics in the future. Uh-huh. Now, let me say, Julia Salabank, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your interest in the book and for reading it so thoroughly.
I've been talking to Julia Salabank about attitudes to endangered languages. This is Chris Cummins for New Books and Language saying thank you for listening.